The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So today, the topic that I'd like to reflect on and explore with you, and my hope is, we'll see how this goes. I so often hope to speak for less time and have more time for discussion. And yet the mind just keeps finding things to say. So I'll just try to keep it a little more brief today so there can be more time for questions and discussion. But the topic I'd like to explore is faith. Now, we may almost immediately have a kind of a sense of, oh, faith, you know. I did when I first started practicing this practice. I came partly because I had heard that the Buddhist practice was more about acting, meditating, and looking, observing at what's happening than believing in something. And so my own relationship with faith was a little bit... I had ideas about what faith was when I started this practice that came from my conditioning as a child, with the religion I grew up with as a child. And my own connotation about faith, it wasn't terribly positive. I had a belief that what it meant was believing in something that you couldn't see, couldn't confirm, and having a very rational mind. My mind didn't particularly want to go there. So I'd just like to explore a little bit about what this quality is here in the context of our spiritual practice in terms of this exploration of our experience, of our hearts and minds. This is essentially what the Buddha found for himself, that exploring our experience, learning how to be present for what is happening in our experience in the present moment, he found this to be very freeing, that this exploration of how our minds are, how our minds and bodies interact, provided a huge releasing of struggle, of suffering, of stress. And so this was his own exploration. And what faith relates to in the Buddhist practice isn't so much about, it's definitely not about believing in a god. It's more about the journey that the Buddha undertook. His question was, is it possible to be free from suffering? He looked out at the world and saw so much suffering and looked at his own life and saw, you know, aging, illness, death around him, and realized he too was subject to aging, illness, and death. And, you know, the relationship that we have to those facts of life often creates a lot of agitation, reactivity in the mind. Another big piece that we react to is the fact that a lot of what happens to us in the world is not within our control. That, you know, things happen. The Buddha talked about what he called the eight worldly winds: praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, pleasure and pain. These things, he said, are just going to come like the weather. You know, it's like this is the way human beings interact. This is stuff that happens in life, and those things aren't going to change. But what his discovery was that it's not those things themselves, not the pleasure, the pain, not the gain and loss, not the fame and disrepute, that actually makes us suffer. But rather it's our reactivity, it's reaction in the mind. It's the fact that we don't like pain, that we don't like loss, that we try to hold on to when we've gained something and feel that we've made a mistake when it slips away. That reactivity of our minds is where the Buddha found in his own experience, if there could be a a shift of relationship to all of the flow of life, that's where he found ease and peace. Now, this shift of relationship, the exploration is, you know, can we be at ease with whatever the worldly conditions are? Being at ease with whatever the worldly conditions are doesn't mean sitting like a lump on a log. Doesn't mean not acting. It does mean not reacting, but rather responding from a place of open-heartedness, of connection, of kindness, of friendliness, of compassion. So this is the movement of the heart. As it lets go of reactivity, the motivations of the heart become much friendlier, much more compassionate, and more balanced. So the movement in our practice is not one of just kind of saying, oh, well, things as they are, that's what we're supposed to do. Just accept things as they are and not do anything. What the opening of the heart here is that we, essentially, it's really about accepting what has already happened, right? I mean, there may be pleasure, there may be pain in our world, there may be a loss in our situation, and that is there already. And so can we open our hearts to what is here already, and with that open-heartedness step forward with compassion and kindness, rather than anger and hatred and wanting and blame and confusion. That's the movement. And the Buddha Buddha discovered this possibility of this relaxed heart in response to the world. So this was the Buddha's discovery. And essentially, in terms of faith, what the first step of faith, or confidence, another word perhaps for what faith is in this practice, is a trust, first of all, that the person, the Buddha, living 2,600 years ago, actually found a way towards this ease, this peace, this non-reactivity, responsive rather than reactive, that he found a path. And that that path is something that we can engage with. So, you know, the Buddha's awakening, his discovery of this truth, also came for himself, and we are very fortunate. I mean, it's said that very, very few people can come to this kind of understanding and be able to teach about it. That there may be many more people who can come to this kind of understanding in themselves, but not be able to articulate it in a way that the rest of us can understand it. And so it's said that the Buddha is one of those rare people who could both understand and free his own mind and be able to articulate to others how we can do the same for ourselves. So this was his gift to us. Not only that he found this way, actually, maybe you could sit in one of those chairs so that it's okay. I just don't want you to fall over. So not only that he found the way for himself, but that he could articulate and offer something to us, offer some tools, a path. So his exploration of the of this is very much about exploring what he did. What he explored was in his own heart and mind. His question was, "What is this suffering?" And through that question, that exploration, he discovered, he found that suffering, as I described, was about the reactivity more than what was happening in the world. And exploring that reactivity became his path. So I look at the Buddha as being a real scientist in a way. He wanted to understand in his own experience what was going on, what was causing it, And then, you know, to see, can with this equation of knowing what's causing the suffering and the suffering, is the mind able to let go of those causes? So that was his exploration. And he found for himself this freedom and offered to us, hey, I did it. You can do it too. So we're asked in our path, if what we're interested in is this kind of ease, this kind of peace, this kind of non-reactivity, to trust. That's another good word for translation of faith, is trust. So trust, confidence, faith, all translate the same Pali term, sada, which I'm told literally means to place one's heart upon. So what is it that we place our hearts upon? What is it that we trust? And the Buddha suggests that it's helpful to trust that, I mean, for us it's helpful to trust, first of all, that the Buddha found a way and that his tools will help us. Then the third part of the trust that we really have to cultivate, in some ways those two may be the easy ones that we can see that, you know, we see demonstrations of this perhaps in some of our friends or some of our teachers of how much ease there is for them and non-reactivity and how they navigate life seems so much more peaceful. And so we may get a sense of confidence that comes from seeing how others are. And yet the other part of this trust or this confidence is that we have can develop the confidence in ourselves to do this work. Because what we're asked to have faith in here is not simply an idea. It's not just something to believe in. It's something to act on. So the teachings that the Buddha offered were not simply statements to be believed, but practices to put into effect. So his articulation, one of the key ways that this teaching was articulated, again, you know, the Buddha having this capacity to say, hey, this is what I did. Try it. See what works. See if it works for you. And, many people in his day tried it and also found that freedom themselves, which is how this has propagated. It has found its way to us not only through the recording of the teaching, but also through the living practice. And that's really the way it's passed. Gil says sometimes that the teaching is passed from warm hand to warm hand, because one warm hand can understand it for oneself. And that demonstration is where the inspiration comes. So we're asked to engage. The main way that this is articulated in the Buddhist teachings is in the teaching called the Four Noble Truths, which right there, it sounds like, oh, truth, something to believe, right? And the truths are articulated, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. The truth of suffering is very much what I described a few moments ago, that the suffering in our hearts and our minds is not so much about what's happening in the world, but more about our heart's response to it, how we react, how we contract, how we're fearful, confused, angry, wanting things to be other than they are. So this is the exploration around suffering. So there is this kind of suffering in our hearts and our minds. This is the first noble truth. The second noble truth, the suffering has a cause. It's not random. It's not a random event in our lives. And actually, as the Buddha understood it, he was really a scientist. He understood it. There was a causal phenomenon happening all through the world. And we can look at this and see, you know, And certainly modern science also shows the cause and effect relationship between things, and some of it more probability than necessarily direct cause and effect. But the cause and effect of, like, for instance, of genetics. So you plant an apple seed and an apple tree grows. You don't get an orange tree. Just cause and effect around genetics, around our bodies too. Like, you know, there's the fact that sight happens when light rays hit our eyes, but when light rays hit our ears, we don't see. And so there's a cause and effect relationship to how seeing happens. Light rays hit our eyes. We close our eyes, the seeing doesn't happen, or the seeing of forms in the room doesn't happen. So, you know, the cause and effect condition of our body taking in stimulus. And then he also explored the cause and effect relationship of our mental responses. That when we react out of confusion, out of not liking things, wanting to push things away, out of holding on, wanting to hold on to things, when we react in those ways, the Buddha said those are the reactions that tend to lead us to suffering. Those are the things that lead us to this not being able to meet and be with this flow of changing conditions in the world. It's this greed, this hatred, this aversion, this confusion, this delusion. Those reactions in the mind are what create this suffering, what create this experience of being unhappy, of being confused, of being out of control, of wanting to hold on to things. So the cause, then, of this suffering is this reactivity. The third noble truth being the Buddha basically acknowledging and saying, look, it's possible for this to end. This ending of this reactivity ends the suffering that we have. Now, it doesn't end the gain and loss. It doesn't end the pleasure and pain. It doesn't end people telling us they like us or don't like us. The fame and disrepute, it ends the suffering around it. So this possibility of freedom, this is one of the places we're asked to trust. This is a place that it's possible to have that freedom. And the fourth noble truth, that there's a path leading to the ending of suffering. Tools, practices that help us to find our own way. And essentially the Eightfold Path, this is the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path offers a set of tools for us to engage with, to practice with. So the entire Four Noble Truths, it's a statement of the Buddha's understanding of the world, but it doesn't just stop there, and it doesn't say just believe this and you'll be happy. What he says is engage with this, and he actually suggests actions to come along with these Four Noble Truths. So each truth has an action associated with it. So this is where we engage again. He says we need to understand suffering. And understanding here not meaning think about it, you know, like we're really good at thinking about things, you know. May see that the way we're reacting to a particular person has to do with how we reacted to a parent, for instance. You know, so we may see some of those connections and think about it and think, well, gosh, you know, I'm projecting here. You know, we have all this lingo from Freud and psychology at our disposal to help us understand in our minds, understand intellectually what's going on. But this is not the kind of understanding the Buddha was pointing to. When he said understand suffering, what he was suggesting is a very unusual shift. Not so unusual for those of you who've been hearing this for a while, but the shift being, what is the experience of suffering in your being? How is suffering felt? So the shift here is to turn the attention away from the what we think might be the source of our suffering, away from the loss itself, away from the pain itself, away from the fact that people are disparaging us, saying things about us that we don't like, and to how it feels to be in that situation. What does it feel like to be a human being that's angry? What does it feel like to be a human being that's confused? What does it feel like to be a human being that wants something, that's leaning out to try to get something? What does it feel like to want to control, to fix, to change? So to turn towards that experience. This is what the Buddha meant by understanding suffering. So this acting, this takes some faith too. So the movement in our practice, first of all, we may hear it, and this initial kind of exploration of the teachings, we have to kind of know what we're having faith in, right? We need to, we don't have faith in nothing. There's faith comes with something that we have faith in. And in this situation, faith is in the both the teachings and the effectiveness, perhaps, that we have a sense of confidence that when those teachings are applied, acted on, they will have some kind of an impact on us. So this is our step. This is how we begin our practice. We listen to the teachings a little bit and maybe have a sense of, gosh, that sounds like, I don't know, like for myself, the way this unfolded was kind of interesting, you know. I heard some of the early teachings. I heard somebody sent me a book. I was really suffering, so I had met suffering. This was, you know, this is actually said to be a supporting condition for faith to arise when we meet suffering. But just meeting suffering itself is not enough for faith to arise. There needs to be something to have faith that there could be a direction, a way out of that suffering. So the other supporting condition for faith to arise is that we hear a teaching, hear something, somebody saying, gosh, you know, I tried this. This helped me. Why don't you try it? And in my early days of practice, I was really suffering, and I reached out to a lot of my friends, and one of them sent me a book and said, this helped me. Why don't you try reading this book? And it was a book about Buddhist practice. And I read the book, and I was actually in the Peace Corps, so I didn't have access to teachers. There wasn't internet. I couldn't listen to podcasts. You know, it was like that. I had this book. That's all I had. And so I read this book, and it's like, it didn't make much sense to me, you know. But I gleaned a little bit from this book, some little bit of wisdom that said, it was something like, the way I articulated it to myself was, rather than acting on your difficult emotions, see if you can be with them. Turn your attention towards the feeling of your difficult emotions. And so my main difficult emotion at that time was anger. So it's like, okay, well, I'll try this. And my mind said, I have no idea how this is going to work. It didn't have confidence in the effectiveness of the teaching, actually. My mind did not have confidence in the effectiveness of the teaching. I could not see any way, shape, or form how paying attention to my anger would help. My mind said, won't that just make me more angry? I mean, that's what I thought. So, but I was willing to try because the book said this will help, and my friend said this really helped me. So I borrowed the faith from the book, and I borrowed the faith from my friend. And I said, okay, I have no idea how this is going to work, but I'm willing to try it. And that is also, that may be the very first step of faith, willing to run the experiment. And for me, I very much have a scientific mind, you know, that's my training, essentially. And so running the experiment, it's like, okay, you know, let's just run the experiment. I'll see what happens if I start noticing what it feels like to be angry. Let's see what happens. And within a very short time, I understood directly how that was helpful. Because what I saw in this exploration was not that it made me more angry, but actually that this turning towards the feeling, you know, not the thoughts, that was a key. And I don't quite know how I figured that out, but I think the emphasis in the book was talking about, what does it feel like to be angry? Just know what it feels like. And so, you know, I wake up into anger, it's like, wow, this is not pleasant. Oh, this doesn't feel good. And the next thing I could do is, well, I don't know what I do with this. I guess I go back to work, you know, okay. So what I began to see was that that just simple meeting of anger gave the mind some space around the anger. I was no longer caught in the loop of anger. And within a few weeks even, I began to see that there was much less anger, really full-blown anger, rage kind of anger, happening in my life because the mindfulness was meeting the experience. And it was somehow, and this part I didn't understand at the time, it was somehow allowing it to not get worse. So very quickly, within the few weeks, I saw for myself the benefit of this. So it went from being what we would call, sometimes it's called bright faith, where we don't know for ourselves, but we're borrowing faith. We're borrowing the faith from our teachers. We're borrowing the faith from what others have written, to what might be called verified faith, because I could see for myself just how helpful this was. So we are asked to explore our suffering, understand suffering. And that was essentially a different way to say what I understood from that. Well, it's helpful to just observe your feelings rather than act on them. That's another way to say that. Understand your suffering. Be with it. Feel that experience rather than acting on it. So very quickly I saw the benefit of that. And what I experienced in that was the second noble truth, which is the letting go of the cause of suffering. Letting go of the cause. And I didn't understand how this was happening, but it was certainly happening because so much less reactivity was happening. And now I see the letting go of the cause. Looking back, I can see that the cause of a lot of the suffering was the thought process in the mind and the self-justification, the lashing out that was happening, that cycled back. You know, there's often the anger, often our difficult emotions begin with some kind of a thought in our mind. A memory arises, for instance. And in that moment, a memory arises and we start thinking about it. And if we're not aware of this process, those thoughts often will feed a reactivity. And so the cause of that cycling of the anger that I was experiencing was this kind of reactivity in the mind feeding the anger. The anger fueling yet more reactivity in the mind, fueling more anger. Fueling yet more reactivity in the mind, fueling yet more anger. Building the anger up into a rage. And the letting go that started to happen was that cycle between thought and reactivity, thought and emotion, was let go. So that was the letting go that started to happen. So this is the second noble truth the Buddha suggests, letting go of the cause of suffering. In my own experience here, this letting go wasn't something I chose to do. It happened as the mind understood the suffering from this new perspective. And this is very much the way I've seen it unfold over the course of my practice, that this action of the second noble truth, let go of the cause of suffering, we hear that and we think, I'm supposed to stop the cause. I'm supposed to stop this reactivity. Anger's arising, that's making me suffer. How can I stop this anger? The way I've seen this happen in my own practice is it's not trying to stop it, because the trying to stop it is often motivated by some kind of aversion, a wanting to get rid of, a pushing down or repressing, which is a reaction itself. And so if we can meet the experience, just open to be with, my own experience has been the understanding of suffering in that way allows the whole mind-body system to naturally start to let go of the causes of suffering through that movement of turning towards our reactivity. The mind, with this mindfulness, gets an education. And typically we're so focused outwards on what is happening in the world that we're not seeing how it's impacting us. When the mind begins to understand how it is impacted and how it's participating in the reactivity to how it's being impacted, the mind itself starts to shift direction. Because inherently our organism, our mind-body process, in a very natural way, wants to head towards well-being. But we don't usually give it the information it needs to do that, because we're so much caught in the world of our thoughts and our ideas and our opinions and our views. So our thoughts, our opinions, our ideas about how we want to be happy overrides the actual information that can give us the way that will lead towards well-being. So this, again, this takes some sense of confidence initially, especially sense of trust that this movement of turning towards and being with feelings will support us. Because initially when we do this, it's hard. So many of our thoughts, essentially the way our mind has conditioned itself, is that we think that our thoughts are, we have a habit of using our thoughts to try to think our way out of suffering. But what paradoxically what that often does is we actually think our way into suffering. So this this trust to come back and meet and be with the feelings can be challenging at first. Sure. Ned, could you use the mic?
Not sure how appropriate this is. I'm presently in a circumstance where I feel stuck. And in listening to you talk, I'm wondering if there's another way I can look at it as opposed to the word stuck.
If the feeling is stuck, one way, I mean, this is the paradoxical shift, is what is the feeling of stuck? Rather than engaging with the stuck, how does it feel to feel stuck? The stuck is probably mixed up with a whole lot of other stuff. Feelings, sadness, confusion, loss, grief, anger, wanting. And kind of often the way into this understanding of what's happening is not to try to change the way we're thinking about things or to figure out things, but rather to meet what's most obvious here. When we stop resisting, so often the feeling of stuck comes with, how do I get unstuck? You know, the mind thinks, how do I get unstuck? And here the exploration is, rather than thinking about how do I get unstuck, what does it feel like to be with stuck? What is that experience? Stuck. And what often will happen in the opening to that, letting go of the trying to figure out how to get unstuck, that's the shift, I think, that is the difference. Is rather than feeling stuck and trying to figure something out, opening to the feeling itself, you may quickly find these other feelings beginning to surface. And that is where it starts to move. And your relationship to those feelings. You know, we not only have relationships to things happening in the world, we have relationships to things happening inside of us. So we may have views or opinions about anger. You know, anger, that's not a good thing. I shouldn't be feeling that. Or, you know, so there's the feelings that come up, and the movement is towards allowing the feelings. And it's like a new way of gathering information. Our typical way of gathering information in the world has to do with how we think about it and how we think about our emotions. We feel an emotion like anger, and we think about, well, what is this about? And what do I need to do about this? And what do I need to tell that person about this situation? So, you know, we move into the world of our thoughts. And this new way of gathering information is kind of a trust, again, coming back to faith, a trust that this exploration of the kind of messiness of the feelings will begin to show us the way out. And it's not a process that happens quickly often. It can be a kind of a gradual unfolding. And so this is another place that trust comes into play, the trust of the, sometimes it's like we bargain with our trust, you know. Well, I'll trust you if you give me a result today. So, you know, this kind of trust has got a much longer trajectory. In my own exploration of the path, I've had a few times, you know, I can probably count them on two hands, where this observation of experience led to a really kind of rapid and quick shift in my mind and a letting go, a dramatic letting go. Very few incidences of that. Much more a slow, gradual shift. And yet, I mean, for instance, the story about the anger that I had, that confidence, that willingness to engage with the anger from this new perspective, gave me the confidence that the path was the right direction pretty quickly, because I could see very quickly the shifts that began to happen. You know, that much less reactivity. So the small kind of verification, a little, I can see this direction, this looks useful. It was a couple of years before that anger fully unwound to the point where it was not even possible to conjure it up anymore. So there was a gradual unwinding of that anger. And, you know, there were small releases, times where, oh, there's the anger, and feeling it let go, feeling it dissipate, seeing how I was much less reactive than I had been. So there was that kind of thing, but also seeing it come up over and over again. You know, not giving up. When we see that, you know, oh, looking at my anger for half an hour, does it make it go away forever? You know, that looking at my stuckness, going to be, you know, this is something we commit to over the long haul. And we also do with this willingness to commit. I mean, even for myself, over the space of a couple of weeks, I saw the power of this shift, this change of perspective. And so that gave me confidence. So this is another thing, that confidence, the initial confidence is about taking on faith that the practice will be helpful. And then we get these small verifications. Oh, I see it is helpful, which inspires us or inclines us to keep trying, to keep going, which gives us more recognition of how helpful it is, which inclines us to keep going even more. And my own kind of moment of, there was kind of a moment when the faith got really strong. You know, I was seeing how this was helpful. But at one point, a couple months into this process of watching the anger, I was doing something, and in that doing, I saw a thought arise in my mind about the person I was angry with, and I saw that the kind of inclination. I also saw in that moment that this was just in my daily life. Actually, I hadn't done much sitting meditation by this point. This, I think, really points to the power of mindfulness in our daily lives. I didn't even start sitting meditation for 3 or 4 months after I met this practice, because I was mostly interested in understanding my anger in my life. So that's where I was exploring. That's what I was looking at. And just that practice began to have me kind of attune and get familiar with the state of anger coming together. And the mindfulness began to naturally, organically arise as that was happening, which circumvented the big arisings of anger. And then one day, while doing this thing, I saw this thought about this person come into my mind, the person I was angry with, and I saw this kind of urge in the mind to, like, jump on that thought and think more thoughts in order to get angry. Having spent several months observing anger, feeling anger, being with anger, the mind knew intimately that that way lay suffering. That way lay pain, that anger cycle. And so the mind itself, seeing that urge, simply let it go. I didn't have to. So this is another place of the abandoning, right? The abandoning, the letting go of the cause of suffering. The mind saw it's headed towards suffering, and the mind said, I don't think so. And it just let it go. And actually, it just dropped it. It just vanished. The mind just let go of the urge. Maybe that's the thing to say. The mind let go of the urge to think thoughts to get angry. It just stopped doing that. And I didn't actually trust it in that moment, because I never had this person come into my mind without anger arising. And so I kind of stood there waiting to get angry. And it didn't happen. My confidence got really strong. And my mind said something like, oh my gosh, this stuff is really powerful. Sure. Use the mic. We use the mic here for that.
All right, I can.
There's a little light on the side. Okay, and hold it kind of, talk right into the
okay.
Top, yes.
I can understand reaching a point where suddenly you don't go down the path that you've been going down, but your mind keeps firing and it's still conscious. So it would be very interesting to me if you could reveal or remember, where did your mind consciously go at the moment the flash came? I'm not going down that road because I know where it goes.
It went.
Where
to
else did your mind go?
The mind went to the release of. The mind felt the. This is a funny way to say it, but what I think the mind felt in that moment was the non-arising of anger. It felt the peacefulness of not getting angry.
There's a moment of complete peace.
It was a moment of peace, and the mind kind of hovered in that place for a few minutes.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, whatever that was.
It
was it's very hard to articulate.
It does start up again.
Well, I mean, the what started up in that moment, I mean, as I said, I kind of waited there to get angry. And in certain situations, if the mind had fired up another thought of that person, I might have jumped on it and gotten angry. If it fired up, you know, because sometimes that can happen, you know. The mind can let go once. It can let go twice. A third, a fourth, a fifth time, it's like, oh, it just jumps right on. So that does happen.
It doesn't leave you alone.
In this case, what happened was that the direction the mind took at that moment was that it picked up the amazement. It picked up the amazement at the power of this tool, and it was astounded. And so it went down that path. The mind went down that path of thinking about, wow, this stuff's really powerful. Oh my gosh, you know. So it went down that path, and it didn't go back down the path of picking up the thought about that person.
So that's sort of a revelationary type.
It was, yes, it was.
Which
a
then gave you the faith to believe that that would repeat itself.
Yes, absolutely. So that was what we call that's really strong verified faith. I wouldn't say my faith was unshakable at that point, but it really got to the point where it was like, I'm going to keep doing this, you know. This is good stuff. This helps. I mean, I could see directly in the moment how the mind did not get angry.
Was this before you began sitting?
It was.
Well, after the guided meditation this morning, I told myself that I needed to consider how I behaved in a meeting yesterday. It's a board meeting. I am the president of the board, and the past president is still on the board, and the past president drives me nuts because she takes over, as she had to when she was president, and she still does that. And I got testy with her yesterday, as I have done before. So all I did during the meditation, I'm sorry to say, was to think about it. But your talk has moved me to a different level. And I became aware of anger and sadness and hurt. Mm-hmm. And now I'm somehow on loneliness. Mm. Loneliness in the sense that I keep others at bay, I think. This is a thinking.
Yes, yes. Good, and good to recognize the distinction. The thinking is not our enemy.
I keep others at bay because then they can't hurt me deeply, I think, which doesn't turn out to be true. And under all that, it seemed, as I've been listening to the talk, that fundamentally I need people to reassure me all the time, or most of the time. I need someone, I want someone to reassure me that I'm doing okay.
You want the praise.
Yes. And in the role that I'm talking about as president of a board, I find it hard to believe that I'm doing okay. I don't know what that is yet. So I guess where I am is I gotta sit. I'm going to try your suggestion, if it's not a prescription, to try to sit with that feeling of loneliness and inadequacy.
Yeah, and the other piece here, as you described it, it was a very organic unfolding. This kind of what I was talking about, like, you know, the exploration around stuckness might reveal just this kind of complexity, right? So you started with the frustration around the interaction and was very rich in terms of the whole variety of things you noticed. That all unfolded very organically. You didn't dig. You didn't even know the loneliness was there, probably, to start with. And so that's kind of a surprise. And so now the thing I will encourage you about is to not, now having seen that, to not look for it when you have that frustration in the meeting. So you may say, oh, there's frustration in the meeting. Oh, I've got to figure out where I'm lonely. You know, and then we start digging and say, I know that that loneliness is right in the middle. I got to get there. Allow it to be the organic unfolding still, you know, of what the threads are that come to the surface as you're mindful. Like each time we meet a situation, we get a new perspective on it. And you may get, if you're not digging or don't have the agenda of where to get, you may come up with a whole new angle in, a whole new set of things there. And over time, it's like all the various threads will begin to come to the surface. So when the loneliness comes to the surface, that's when to be with it and not like to try to construct it. But since it has come to the surface, it's more likely to be available. Yeah.
I'd say I have faith in that.
Being with it sort of disarms it.
Indeed.
All right.
And that's another place of trust. And like mind-blowing recognitions along those lines early in my practice. Like another story, which those of you who've heard me for a while, you've heard this story again, but I just will share this one. We've only got a minute here anyway. So observing loneliness, one of the things I was observing was loneliness in those early days. And again, much in my daily life, watching loneliness. And watching the process of loneliness begin, I was seeing a pattern that it was arising on conditions, often happening when I went to bed at night. And then surprisingly, as I observed that, that the loneliness began as I was setting an alarm clock. And that was confusing. Like, why on earth would loneliness begin with an alarm clock? But that's when it was very clear. It was like flipping a switch. I pick up the alarm clock and loneliness came. And just curious, you know, being with it, watching that loneliness day after day, I saw, again, it was a trigger, a thought. The seeing the clock triggered a thought about being with someone where we were looking at a clock. And that person was the person I was lonely about. And so I saw in that moment that the sense impression of the clock had triggered the memory, and then that the memory had triggered loneliness. The thinking about that person and the feeling of loss around that person. I was never going to, you know, have that same relationship with that person again. So that whole thing kind of cascaded into a lonely feeling. The surprise, the kind of mind-blowing surprise that your comment triggered for me, was that the next night, after I had seen that whole thing, picking up the alarm clock, that thought came into my mind. Of course that thought came into my mind. The loneliness did not. It was the seeing of the link. You know, the link made conscious, the link of that thought triggering loneliness made conscious, broke the power of that link.
It broke the link because the link was in the past and gone.
It broke the habit of the mind to pick up that thought and turn it into loneliness. That was the link that got broken. And it's just stunning. I mean, if you can step into this willingness with trust to turn towards the unfolding flow of experience, it's mind-boggling what the mind can understand and let go of and move towards happiness instead of reactivity. So it's time to stop. Thank you.